Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
This is one of those stories that starts with a news event that makes bold headlines.
The markets in Asia and the U.S. falling sharply on news that a top Chinese executive has been arrested in Canada.
Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou appearing today in B.C. Supreme Court. She's since been released on $10 million bail, awaiting possible extradition to the U.S., a move she's vowed to fight.
From there, the narrative splits into stories about retaliation, stories about political posturing, trade stories and business stories and technology stories. Most of these items are small enough that unless you're really paying attention, you might not notice them. But they are all part of the same big story. And that story is still unfolding, even when it's not dominating headlines.
Yesterday, the U.S. president signed an executive order effectively banning U.S. telecom companies from using Huawei technology for 5G. This is the next...
Canada updating its travel advisory for China, telling Canadians to exercise a high degree of caution in China.
Canada's rocky relationship with China hit another bump today. Beijing has now blocked canola imports from a second Canadian producer, Viterra, over alleged contamination by pests. Is it...
And so then, one day, you look up, and your country is 4 months out from an important election and finds itself caught directly between two superpowers with no easy way out. So what happens now? How did Canada and China's relationship end up here? Can the Liberals really soften their talk and de-escalate tensions in the middle of an election? And if they do that, and Donald Trump doesn't like it, what happens then? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is a big story about a rock and a hard place and us. David Moskrop is one of our favorite geopolitical analysts. He is a political scientist, and he is the author of Too Dumb for Democracy. Let's start with the really basic, simple stuff. How is Canada's relationship with China right now?
It's pretty awful. Unless something has changed in the last couple of hours, and I don't think it has, it is at one of the lower points that it's been at in years. When I was doing my master's, I became deeply interested in international relations and China, and so took a course on China, studied IR, studied global international political economy, and so that's the baseline that I'm going from my head. I tuned out for a couple of years. I was expecting to move to China, and I didn't. But then in the last year or so, I've dialed back in, and especially in the last 6 months. And there's been a notable decline since Canada arrested Meng Wanzhou on request of the Americans, who would like her extradited to the U.S., where she's indicted on a couple dozen or so charges of working with Iran, which is under American sanctions. And that was really the sort of opening salvo in a deteriorating relationship between Canada and China. And that sort of decline has been marked by, obviously, the arrest, but then China banning Canadian canola imports, arresting two Canadian nationals, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, sentencing two Canadians to death on drug charges, and Canada considering banning Huawei for 5G technology, which the Americans would very much like us to do. So there's, you can see from that sort of quick rundown of the last several months, half a year or so, a growing tension, but a fundamental rift surrounding largely long-term geopolitical interests.
Explain for me, if you can, how Huawei is tied to the Chinese government, because I think here in the West, in the coverage that we get, it almost seems like an arm of the government, and I don't understand that so well.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I mean, I'm not a China expert. I'm a writer, observer, political scientist who studies democracy, interested in this, and so it's something I track across several different types of reporting. So it's interesting to see how different countries report on it, how international media reports on it, but also how business media reports on it versus political media. And one of the things you see is that there is some doubt to the degree to which Huawei is connected to the Chinese government. And as one observer pointed out, there's no smoking gun. But the concern is that either now or at some point, Huawei technology could be used in at least one of two ways to undermine geopolitical interests, including economic interests and corporate interests. And one is through the Chinese government requesting data from the company extraterritorially, and the company right. having to comply. So one is, you know, they show up, the Chinese government says, look, this is the rules, give us the data, and they have no choice. It's a little bit akin to the U.S. Patriot Act, and if you've got stuff, but that's a domestic thing. So if you're a Canadian that uses Gmail and your stuff is stored on American servers, the government, the U.S. government can access that stuff under the Patriot Act, right? I mean, this is one of the concerns with using American servers and American technology. It's a bit like that. So it's not like this is just a China issue. I mean, there are concerns with the United States, for instance, as well. So that's one of them, is that the Chinese government will be able to request that information. And from what I've read, that is generally probably true. If the government asked for it, Huawei would have to provide it. The other is that Huawei would actually build back doors into the technology that would allow spies of the Chinese state to directly access that data through the back door. Now, China has a long history of corporate espionage, stealing ideas, stealing intellectual property. They're not the only ones, of course. I mean, a lot of America was built on stealing intellectual property. But that is part and parcel of the struggle.
You mentioned America a couple of times, first because we arrested a Huawei CFO on their request, and second because there may now be some pressure to not allow Huawei on the 5G network because of them. How does our relationship with the States play into diplomacy with China? And what's Canada going to do if we're caught in the middle?
I don't know. I mean, I would not want to be Chrystia Freeland right now, because there isn't an immediate, obvious, good solution to this if you're thinking geopolitically. I mean, if you're worried about your relationship with the United States for all kinds of reasons, the U.S. has been in long-term decline, then you have a problem. Especially if you want to look around the world and develop new alliances and new relationships, and China's one of those. Especially if you rely on China for things like canola, exporting canola, which is significant for Canadian farmers. On the other hand, you're dealing with Donald Trump, who's mercurial at the best of times, and you're trying to get the U.S. MCA agreement, the U.S. MCA, ratified, which is increasingly difficult and unlikely in the current U.S. Congress. It might have to wait. So what do you do? You're bound to the U.S. for other reasons, too. The border, the movement of goods and individuals, you know, whatever it was, 80% or so of our trade. But also in defense, right? I mean, there are defense arrangements, whether it's NORAD or NATO. And then on top of that, we're part of the Five Eyes intelligence community. And there are U.S. concerns that if those, you know, countries that are part of the Five Eyes allow Huawei technology, they may not want to share intelligence with them for fear that it's compromised. So what do you do if you're Canada? I have no idea. You know, Yves Tiberghien, who's a scholar at UBC, who's a China scholar, an Asia-Pacific scholar, thinks that the immediate move is you de-escalate with China and you try to rebalance that relationship. The more I think about it, the more I think he's onto something. But, and as I've written recently for the Globe and Mail, we also ought to think forward 50 to 100 years and think about what kind of international order we want to be a part of building to ensure that we have a just and ideally democratic world order governed by very careful norms about what countries do to one another and to their own people.
Well, how does China's global strategy play into what Canada's facing? Because you sort of outlined some of their bigger strategies towards trade and trying to lead that international order.
Yeah, so the Chinese Belt and Road, I've become sort of modestly obsessed with the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
Explain exactly what the Belt and Road Initiative is for those of us who are hearing about it for the first time.
So it's several years old now. It dates to give or take 2013. And what it is, in short, just oversimplify a little bit, an attempt to recreate the Silk Road. through a massive, roughly $1 trillion U.S. infrastructure and development program that'll stretch across, give or take, about between 60 and 70 countries and, you know, dozens of organizations. And you know, this is effectively China launching a massive investment throughout the world. Now, you know, depending on how you see it, it's a bit of a Rorschach test for your perspective on China. You could be seen as a development project. It could be seen as a debt trap where China's investing in these countries and then has them on the hook, largely like, by the way, developed countries have been doing around the world for years, in, you know, for instance, through IMF programs. But it's also potentially a projection of military force and building of allyships, strategic partnerships, while in the Americas, in Western Asia, in Africa. It now has a growing military component as well, to some extent, for instance, with Pakistan, who is building Chinese fighter jets. Depending on how you see it, it's some combination of development program, infrastructure program, military program, and debt trap, and big geopolitical play to help China direct the global order in the next century.
If one of the options is to de-escalate with China and ease the tensions and kind of become more of a part of what they're doing, can the Liberal government do that in an election year? I mean, they've been standing tough so far. Can they turn around and de-escalate this thing without losing face? What would the other parties have them do?
I'm very curious to... I mean, Andrew Scheer's line is that he wants to reset the relationship. I don't know what that means or what that would look like. And I don't know if this is a get tough on China plan or what he could possibly do to get tough. The NDP's perspective is that China has been sort of bucking the international order for years, and they talk a lot about rights and rules, but they don't follow them themselves. The Liberals have been trying to, for instance, negotiate some sort of settlement, obviously on canola, but also to try to secure the release of Michael Kovrig and Spavor. China has been hesitant to take meetings, high-level meetings, and we don't have an ambassador in China currently, and the Chinese ambassador is leaving at the end of the month. He's being quote-unquote promoted to Paris.
Huh.
So now he hasn't exactly been, I think, particularly easy to work with. And obviously, if you remember back to John McCallum, who was retired by Prime Minister Trudeau, that relationship wasn't particularly productive, I think, either. So they're caught. So I don't know what they do in an election year, because even if the get tough on China rhetoric might play well to some, it's not going to serve the country well. It's not going to serve canola farmers. It's not going to serve detained Canadians. It's not going to serve two Canadians who are right now have been sentenced to death on drug charges in China. And it's not going to serve our long-term interests. I think the thing that you've got to do is do what's right for the country long-term, de-escalate, but then also think about what a reordering looks like, including potentially a counter-investment program that is a sort of unified North American, even North American-European investment scheme. We have something roughly like that that's being run, but it's sort of peanuts compared to what the government-directed investment is out of Beijing.
Do we have a sense, and maybe this is a silly question to ask about the American administration, but do we have a sense how much rope Canada has here to play between the two powers?
I suspect there are people who do. I think if you were to ask a handful of experts, you'd get a couple of different responses. You know, we're a fairly minor player. That's the fact. We are indeed a medium power, and it's no more evident than anywhere than it is right here. We are caught between two superpowers. But one thing is, China's fairly sensitive about its image. It's fairly concerned about saving face. The Chinese Communist Party governs in part, I mean, the legitimacy comes in part from their ability to secure investment and returns. I mean, the good thing about democracy is if you get your legitimacy from elections. If people don't like you, you lose. The Chinese don't have elections. So the legitimacy of the Communist Party comes from their ability to deliver the goods. That requires them to have trade relationships. And certainly at the moment, that includes Canada and the United States. So there is a moment where I think we can have some influence because we have, there's a trade relationship, and China doesn't want to be an international pariah. But you've got to play those cards very carefully, and we shouldn't overestimate the strength of the hand.
Does Canada have any levers that we can pull? I mean, so far this conversation has kind of been, we're between a rock and a hard place. Is there anything we can, do we have any sticks?
So people often quote Thucydides, but sort of misunderstand the context in which they quote him. There's a great line in international affairs, although that's a bit of anachronism, but in sort of struggles between powers, the strong do what they will and the weak do what they must. Thucydides was critiquing that, but nonetheless, he was right. I think to some extent that applies, that we are on our own, you know, unable to pull very many levers. The one thing that we can do is build an international coalition and an international effort, and to leverage that to get something done. So on his recent visit to Ottawa, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence talked about this and supported Canada in our efforts now to settle this relation, or to settle these challenges with the Chinese. Now, he would do that because the Americans have their own trade war and their own concerns about 5G technology and Huawei and their own geopolitical ambitions. So let's not pretend that the U.S. doesn't have an interest here. But if the goal is to get these Canadians released, to settle the canola issue, then we can potentially build these relationships with other powers and try to leverage that. Especially since China has obviously interest in the U.S. market and the European market. Or we can back down and hope that, you know, several months down the line, an immediate backing down will pay off, right? And it would allow the Chinese to save face. But then I think the question then becomes, okay, what then for the next 50 years? What does that look like? Because for years we've been operating the assumption that if we cooperate with the Chinese, they'll improve their human rights record and they'll democratize even, right? This was what we were told in the 90s,
right?
That you engage because engagement leads to détente, engagement leads to democratization, it leads to the growth of the free market, which supports human rights, et cetera, et cetera. Looking at the Chinese treatment of ethnic minorities and religious minorities, the suppression of rights, Chinese individuals, cyber attacks, economic attacks on countries around the world, I would argue that just simply hasn't worked. So what does the counter look like long term? And I think it looks like some mode of non-exploitative, non-colonial investment around the world, where we try to repair a lot of the damage we've done over the past century and change.
Do we have a sense of how Canadian voters feel about this? First of all, I guess, if they are even considering this as an issue, and second of all, which way they're leaning?
I haven't seen numbers. I would hypothesize that, as with most foreign affairs issues, to the extent that Canadians are paying attention, they'll have, you know, a rough sense of we're in a kerfuffle, but they won't care that much. You know, they'll want us to stand up to China and bring our boys home.
Right.
But, you know, it'll end kind of there, and no one's going to base their vote on it. Not really. It's rare for anyone, you know, there's not a ton of single-issue voters in the first place, and I suspect there are vanishingly few single-issue voters who are concerned with, above all else, our relationship with China.
How dangerous is this game that we're caught up in right now? Is there a worst-case scenario, or is this, you know, diplomatic chess and we might have a canola oil kerfuffle one way and threats made the other way and detentions on both sides, but nothing else really happens? Or is this a crucible, I guess?
I don't think it's a crucible. I mean, again, I'm sort of speaking as an interested observer and not an expert, but my sense is that it's just not going to be worth anybody's time or effort to escalate this much beyond where it already is. If you look at, for instance, military concerns, I don't see any really. The Americans will continue to run ships, you know, next door to China as they have for years, and the Chinese will continue to be irritated. But in the short run, I don't think it's a crucible. I think the long run is, what do you do when the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative is done? in 2050 or 2049, 2050. Then the question is, okay, well, what's the global order look like? Is it going to be a liberal international order? Is it going to be, you know, a liberal democratic international order? Or is it going to be something, I would argue, even better, something that's even more just and inclusive and productive than that? Or is it going to be the sort of realist great power challenge between a declining American empire and a rising Chinese empire? That will be the crucible, I think. And I can't even imagine where Canada is going to be in the middle of that, especially when you figure we'll also be right in the middle of the growth of extreme effects from climate change. That'll be the crucible.
Well, that sounds like something worth looking forward to.
Yeah, I always try to end on a hopeful note, but this time I don't think I have anything.
Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
David Moskrop is a political scientist based in Ottawa and the author of Too Dumb for Democracy, which we probably are. That was The Big Story. For more from us, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. In case you didn't know, well past 200 episodes. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN, and wherever you get your podcasts, Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify are your platform of choice. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk to you tomorrow.